Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Mormon Matters again. This is Dan Weatherspoon, a fifth and final time tonight sharing interviews that I've done today. This has been an exhausting day, but a wonderful day of hopefulness returning to me, healing, great perspectives. And this final one, you will not be disappointed as you listen to it. Maxine Hanks is our guest. Many of you know her as a long time warrior in the church and being engaged with your mind and your heart and your soul and all parts of you in creating this community at a great level. She's a feminist historian, a theologian. She's been a teacher. She edited a breakthrough book called Women in Authority. I should look up the subtitle, but I'm not. She's just been a longtime friend. She speaks a lot at Sunstone. I got to know her mostly during my time there, and I've enjoyed my association very, very much with her, and I think you'll really love what she has to say. She brings some perspectives as somebody who was in one of the September 6 herself, who had to go through major healing of being scapegoated, of being made a symbol and yet still trying to be herself even as that was happening, and coming through to own her part of the conflicts that she was part of back then. And then just, for those who haven't quite heard the end, she came back to the church and rejoined the church, was rebaptized after being excommunicated in 1993. She was rebaptized in 2011. So she brings a lot of journey, a lot of empathy, some perspectives here that are completely missing from the others, and I think that you'll be really pleased. So on with my interview with Maxine. I'm here with Maxine Hanks, and it's kind of a fun bookend for our day. We began with Elbert Peck, who sort of lived on the, he's a major member of the community during the September 6th time, and now we've actually got one of our September 6th, Maxine Hanks. And Maxine, you bring a lot of interesting perspectives to this today, including the sense that I've been getting from you online that you are not 100% sold that this was a directed church action from church headquarters. So I'll let you start wherever you'd like. Do you want to start with that particular angle? Okay, thanks.
Sure, and it's interesting you mentioned Elbert. Elbert and I go way back to the MTC together in 1980. So,
wow, as missionaries, or I know you were both MTC teachers.
We were both working with research and development on the new missionary discussions, changing over from the old rainbow discussions to the booklets
that I did. Yeah.
The new free form where, anyway, it's kind of funny. You asked about why I don't think that these potential disciplinary, well, these calls to disciplinary councils and with potential discipline awaiting, why I don't think they were directed from higher church leadership or headquarters. There are a number of reasons. These are very different scenarios. John has been, having talks and issues and tensions between himself and his local leaders for over a year, which he's alluded to in public. So there's been already a long history of back and forth between him and his leaders. And with Kate, as she mentioned, first she'd heard of it was a letter from her stake president in May last month. So this is a
Didn't she only get that letter emailed to her this weekend? So even though he wrote it at the end of May, she only got the email from her bishop forwarding it along to her.
Yeah, as I understand, it was about a week ago, and I can't comment on the specifics of her case, but
okay.
It's my point is very recent. We're talking the notice that she got referred to a concern arising last month in May. And in the letter from her stake president, which I read online, which they posted at Ordained Women, it seems to almost pretty strongly imply that his taking some kind of action relates to the Ordained Women action in April on Temple Square. He refers to moving ahead, you know, with public, you know, projects and events in defiance against requests and guidance and that she'd been given. And it just seems to me that he's responding to the action on Temple Square. So they're different, very different scenarios. They evolved in very different ways at different times. Also, the official church statement on LDS.org explicitly said these actions did not originate with, you know, the church general higher leadership. These are local actions. So I really don't see this as some kind of coordinated effort from the top.
Okay. So you're willing to give a bigger benefit of a doubt than perhaps what's being offered in most places today, at least in these Facebook groups. And
I don't even see it as a benefit of the doubt. I see it as, you know, people are innocent until proven guilty. And,
right.
You know, I don't see any evidence.
Okay.
At all.
Yeah, and I guess
they both happened to get sort of the final summons this week. I've seen weirder coincidences than that.
Yeah, that is true. And on this, you know, in this series that I'm doing today, the only time that anything that might cause pause as far as belief goes was in the one with Elbert. We've been pretty much staying away from speculating on this, but you know, with Elder Oaks later admitting that Elder Packer did get involved with the people like you and directing your stake presidents, you know, not necessarily to this is how the result has to be,
yeah,
but at least in you should call these people in, that, you know, there's a precedent there of, you know, instructing the church leaders to say this is coming from you, but we strongly urge.
First, I have to say, Dan, that we're talking about two completely different times and places, completely different scenarios, 21 years apart, different people, different contexts, completely different situations. It's pretty hard to compare 1993 and 2014. There are a couple of little parallels, but the differences stack up so huge. I could spend an hour talking about the differences.
Well, I don't have an hour, but
I want
some, because it doesn't seem that different to me on the surface. So lay it out for us. What would be a few?
Okay, well, first, before I mention a couple of differences, I just want to say that even though in our case we did hear secondhand in 1993 that investigation was initiated from a high level, apostolic level, which the church has the right to do, to investigate the writings and, you know, activities of its members and talk to them and find out where they're coming from, how they're feeling, what their intent is. Even though it was initiated, the process and the actual interviewing and decisions were left to the local leaders. And I can absolutely say that was the case. In my case, I did not participate. I didn't cooperate. I didn't want to even attend the council. So anyway, there's actually here's a bit of evidence for the fact that back in 1993 they were each case was situational. Lynn Whitesides worked closely with her bishop and her leaders, collaborated, attended her council, and she was not axed.
Right.
Okay, I didn't attend, Mike didn't attend, Levina didn't attend, we didn't participate, we were all axed. So I'm pretty confident that if I had gone in and participated and really tried to work with them, I would not have been axed. But anyway, so there's a difference between initiating a conversation, an investigation, versus the actual process and decision where that takes place. So in 1993, as well as today, when the church says, you know, these these activities are local, they're honest. They're accurate about that because the process and decision making happens on the local level. But anyway, back to your question about differences between 1993 and today. Oh gosh, not only are we talking completely different scenarios and people and times, it was a different church back then in many ways. And the people, what we were doing back then, was in many ways very different than what people are doing today. So I guess I need to know exactly what you're interested in terms of what you think looks the same or what feels the same to you. And then I can address that.
Well, I guess what feels the same to me is that you guys were saying things and doing things. And especially, I think there is a slight difference between, you know, sharing your ideas and having those be influential. And today, you know, is things where both Kate and John are more activist. So it's not just ideas. But I think that there's a similarity between you're doing that. You guys are becoming vocal. There is some picking up of national attention to these things.
Right.
And
and
it seems like they're picking. Well, if indeed they did pick, we have two people who are one especially on the feminist front, the ordination of women front, the other one who's been pretty active on the GLBT, you know, supporting that front.
Exactly.
It looks like they may have picked a couple of figureheads, if they did, to, you know, to just squelch people, and they got a good result back then, and so it doesn't seem that far-fetched to think that they might be trying the same thing.
You're right. That's true. And that gets to the whole issue of inevitability and the way that this kind of thing happens every generation. It happens every 20 years. It happens.
Okay. That's right. It did happen with Mark Peterson and stuff in the 80s. Yeah.
And it happened in the 70s with Mormons for ERA. Then it happened in the 90s with intellectual scholars, feminists and gays. And now it's happening again in the teens. So it does kind of cycle back every 20 years. And there are similar issues, just different players, different people, different times. And I think one of the things that we have in common is that back then, well, in the 70s and the 90s and today, we all were voicing dissent. There were plenty of scholars and feminists in the 70s and 90s who weren't interrogated or disciplined. It was the ones who were offering dissenting views, either dissenting with regard to policy, or mostly actually policy and practice, or dissenting in some way toward doctrine, and doing that dissent in public. So through a public voice, writing, speaking, public actions, and that is the same. Today, it's offering a dissenting point of view that dissents or differs, let's say, from current policy or practice, or perhaps even doctrine, and doing that in public. That we have in common. And it is, I will say, it is a bit of deja vu for me. And when I'm looking at some of the statements in the church leader letters from the stake president and bishop, and when I'm listening to what John and Kate are saying today, hearing their interviews, and then when watching how people are reacting on the blogs, I'm hearing some of the same statements verbatim that I heard in 1993. In the letter from the stake president and bishop, from
There's got to be a form of some sort that they build, you know, the structure around, don't you think?
Well, there's difference in sameness. I would have to contrast.
Okay.
You know, if I contrast Kate's stake president's letter from the one I got, very different letters.
Okay,
very, very different, very unique, different people, different situations. But I'm just saying, every now and then I'll catch a phrase. Okay. You know, a phrase like, you know, the church has a need and to be able to monitor its members' activities. And when those members are acting in, you know, defiance or leading other people away, then we have a need to deal with that. I mean, those kinds of phrases, I've heard before. And listening to Kate and John, it brings back things that I said 20 years ago I'd forgotten. But the differences are really striking. I want to mention just a few differences because each generation is dealing with different issues or dealing with them at a whole new level. You know, each generation moves the discourse further and takes it deeper to more complex and sophisticated levels. So it's not just about pushing boundaries for the sake of pushing boundaries.
Right.
And I do not advocate or support the idea that we just need to push and push. And the more we push, you know, the better it is. And somehow we'll all end up in this wonderful, idyllic, homogenous place. No, it's about each generation brings new gifts and insights and is dealing with the culture in a different place, at a different level. And it's a sifting process of evaluating what is cultural, what is flawed, what needs to be healed, what is out of alignment with the gospel. It's a sifting process that is going deeper and deeper and more complex and sophisticated. And so there's a difference between then and now in terms of, for example, policy versus doctrine. Back then, what we were focusing on more for scholarship, particularly dissenting scholarship in public and feminist issues and gay issues, was just the right to do it. It was about identity and voice, just having the right to do it and still be a part of the community. Not be kicked out. So it was more about policy and practice. We weren't challenging doctrinal issues so much. I mean, for gay activists, it was about, I want to be able to be gay and be out and still be in my congregation and be able to attend church and not be kicked out. And for scholars, it was about, I want to be able to do feminist scholarship and not be kicked out. You know, I want to be able to teach Mormon studies at the university. I was co-teaching a Mormon studies class at the university, and I wanted to be able to do that and not live in fear. So, you know, it was more about policy. Today, where I see the discourse going is, I mean, those things are a given. You can be feminist, you can teach feminist studies, you can be gay, you can be in a congregation, you can do dissenting scholarship in public in your work. But now there are engagements with deeper doctrinal aspects and issues. You know, in the past, we were reclaiming women's history and women's own precedent within the tradition. We weren't asking for new revelation to change doctrine about women. Today, it's not just about being able to be gay in your congregation. It's about gay marriage, you know, and can gays hold positions, you know, of leadership. So it's a whole different level. So there's a different level of engagement. Also, the scope is really different. Back then, it was a few, a small minority of people in small circles or groups, and who were doing this sort of heretical or edgy work, you know.
Own it.
Heretical, what was seen as heretical. It wasn't heretical. It was utterly within the precedent. As I said, we were focused on excavating precedent and tradition rather than petitioning for new changes in doctrine. But it was a small minority. Today, it's a critical mass. It's multitudes who are going through
the same crisis. Which makes it even more disturbing in some ways that there's so many people that, you know, again, if it's local leaders, I'm hoping it's local leaders only, you know. But if it's something more than that, it's just like, how bad is it? How are they seeing, you know, what are the messages they're getting? We know what we in our kind of half of the conversation are, you know, like we're frustrated with the slowness of movement and stuff on these issues. How many people are yelling at them for, why don't you shut these people down? Why are you not, you know, acting like prophets and declaring God's word? I'm just, that's the only thing I can think of that would lead them, knowing that the scope is so big now,
right,
to do
and
what they did.
Yeah, exactly. And that is one of the reasons I was going to mention. As soon as I had one more item I was going to mention.
Oh,
about,
sure.
No, the difference. But then, no, I want to get to your point. Your point is important as to why is this happening? To quote that great line from Twin Peaks, you know, at the end, it is happening again. You know, that surreal deja vu. That's what I keep thinking of, is that line from Twin Peaks. It is happening again. But why is it happening again? I have some thoughts about that. But another, and this leads right into it, another difference or shift that I see is that back then we were working more in private spaces and scholarly spaces and not so much public activism. I mean, the activism,
definitely.
Yeah, the activism that was happening in the 80s and 90s was about political stuff outside of church. It was pro-choice rallies at the Capitol. It was gay rights rallies downtown. It wasn't public activism about the church. Back then, it was private work. It was private, even though we had public voice through our articles and our writings and speaking at Sunstone. It was, I would say, a more private work. Whereas today, it's very public and very activist in many, many ways, and it's a public presence. That's the word I want to get at, is the public presence of dissenting voices that they have on the internet and in public is just huge. Whereas back then, it was a very private, secluded kind of presence, if you could even call it presence back then. But as to the reasons why, exactly, I number one on my list of why is it happening again? Why am I suddenly transported to 1993? Because of the scope, the numbers, the critical mass moment, which is not really ultimately about John or Kate. It's so much bigger than them. So they symbolize something. But we did too. We each symbolized something in 1993. And again, I want to get at the deeper meaning and purpose in all of this. It's not all bad news, even though it's a terrible thing to have to go through. But there's a way in which it's inevitable. It's unavoidable that when you have differences and conflicts in a religious community, they come to a head, they come to a crisis, and there's a confrontation. And that's a moment. It's a decisive moment when you have an opportunity to learn and grow and see yourself better and know yourself better and learn from each other and rise above it and do something productive with it that is focused on greater wisdom and integration of self and self-knowledge. So the issue, the real test becomes not so much what's happening. It's not the thing that's happening that's so terrible. It's what are we doing with it? How are we engaging it? How are we dealing with it, all of us at all levels? And so they're symbolic, and I have nothing but tearful sympathy for John and Kate in terms of being in that role, because on the day when that happens, there's a new public self that is created that doesn't belong to you. It belongs to everybody else. So the day that it happened for me, there was another Maxine that was created, you know?
This is really insightful. Yes,
And I
speak.
began, yeah, I've been, I began having to exist on these two levels, this meta public level where I understood that I was playing a role for other people, including the church leaders. I played a role for them. I symbolized something for them.
Yes.
And they needed to work through something by working through me. And Kate and John have been selected to play that role for the group, selected by fate more than anything,
Yes.
and some aspect of the collective unconscious that needs them to play that role. They're both very archetypal figures, in my opinion.
Wow, this is great.
And so we need to support them and not put more stress on them than they already have, because it's huge when you are carrying a role for an entire community. And so we need to support them and love them, and we also need to help each other and our community understand what's happening so that we're not afraid of it. And that we do something productive with this whole thing that's happening. This is an opportunity for us to learn. And this is a confrontation with self. When this happens, it's a confrontation of the self, the Mormon self, and in trying to know itself better through these people and through these events. And so, yes, it's about John and Kate, but it's also much bigger, and we need to recognize that they're not bad. They're the people who fate has picked out. And also, I think number two on my list as to why, so this number one is why this is happening, is that it's the scope. They represent where the critical mass discussion is right now in 2014. Because people who are going through faith crises and people who are doing revisionist history and encountering feminism and awakening to all this stuff, the number is so huge that we're at a point right now where the Mormon psyche, the collective psyche, needs to confront itself on this again and have some more symbolic figures help to focus this experience and play this role so that we can, work with this and try to figure it out. So we're at a critical mass point, and so they represent where the evolution of the Mormon psyche and personality is right now in 2014, and what it needs right now to understand itself better. And so that would be number one on my list as to why it's happening. It's so much bigger than Kate's stake president or John's bishop, you know. And so we need to focus on learning from this, and we do need to pray for everybody, that everybody from the leaders to the members to Kate and John will all learn from this, and that we will do something productive with this.
Nice.
That we will learn what we're meant to learn. Number two is, I think that the big concern is that John and Kate represent a movement and leaders of a huge movement. And they represent, I think, to leadership, people who are leading large numbers of people away from belief or adherence to doctrine and current policy and practice. So they're seen as leading people away from belief and practice. That is,
even though there's plenty of evidence that it's the opposite.
Well, and again, I think that it's so much bigger than them. It's not even about them per se, although, you know, John and Kate both are very public, very charismatic, very intelligent, very articulate. They are both leading huge projects in Mormonism.
Right. Okay, very good. I'm totally with you there. I guess what I'm saying is the leaders don't seem to know them, and so they don't listen to how many people are saying, you know, I would have just faded away, but now I'm staying in the wrestle,
or
something like that. And so the leading them away, certainly many people who associate with Kate and with John and with my podcast and everybody who's kind of doing this same sort of work, many don't choose to stay, but before it would have just been quiet desperation. I disappear quietly, and now it's more measurable. It's more visible.
Right. Exactly. And it's so hard to measure. I mean, how many of the hundreds of people, thousands of people who've been influenced and benefited by John DeLynn, how many have left the church? How many have stayed? I mean, it's impossible to measure.
Yeah.
And when I say, and I'm speculating, I mean, I don't have any inside track. I'm just Maxine here in my living room speculating with Dan Weatherspoon.
Thank you.
I don't know. I'm speculating based on reading between the lines of all the documents and voices flooding through my computer in the last couple of days. What I'm hearing, reading between the lines, is there's a concern that John and Kate are leading people away. I don't mean that they're leading them away from the church. Like I said earlier, I think the perception is that John and Kate are leading members away from accepted, established, current doctrine.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And again, I'm speculating about what I'm reading between the lines. I'm not presuming to know any reasons behind anybody's mind as to what's going on. But this is what I'm seeing between the lines, that there's a concern that, for example, John, with Mormon Stories and Discussions, is making it okay and facilitating people to let go of or to reject or to drop beliefs in basic core doctrines like translation of the Book of Mormon, which I wouldn't even call that a basic core doctrine.
Right,
but anyway, what does it mean
if
the Book of Mormon's true? You know,
yes.
Does it mean historically or does it mean spiritually? But there's a perception, let's say, that you know, he's facilitating people to drop or to disbelieve or discard what the church sees as basic core doctrines. And for example, with ordained women, there's a perception, a very strong perception and concern that seems to come through, that ordained women is facilitating women to, say, reject the current doctrinal and policy position on women not being ordained to male offices of priesthood. That ordained women is challenging what is perceived as a doctrinal position that women are not ordained to the male offices. So, you know, I think that's kind of the perception. And again, those are such complex issues. We could talk for a long time sorting those out, but I'm just saying that's what I'm reading between the lines. That's something that does need to be explored better. And I hope that there's a way to do that. I hope there's a way to explore in more detail and in better articulation how and why John and Kate are not leading people into doctrinal apostasy. They are only facilitating public discussion.
Yes, right, of trends that were there for sure.
Yeah, it's public discussion. It's about debating and exploring doctrine in public, you know.
Yes.
And again, this gets back to the private versus public thing I mentioned earlier. There's a difference between a private space and a public space. I think one issue is that it's okay to debate and discuss things in public and secular discourse, but if you bring it into private, sacred church space, church property, church spaces, that seems to be a big concern and a big part of what's happened here in the difference or the contrast between public discourse that's secular in nature and bringing that into sacred spaces on Temple Square during conference, you know, a demonstration at the tabernacle during conference, which is supposed to be sacred space where people are spiritually fed and it's not for doctrinal debates, or, you know, taking those discussions into wards. I think there's concern that the new OW discussions are taking these explorations, which are perfectly legitimate and healthy and good, but taking them into wards. I think there's a real concern. So as I read between the lines, what I saw was a concern that it was okay until the demonstration happened in April on Temple Square, that crossed a line and it was okay.
Yeah, and we saw their response kind of ramp up. You know, you had the October responses and Ruth Todd was, you know, as conciliatory as she could be. But yeah, we had Cody Craner and the others, you know, just talking, you know, pretty roughly, as well as Michael Otterson with his, you know, release to the blogs.
It was definitely a different response. I wouldn't say that they were speaking roughly, but it was a different response than what you saw in October with Ruth in person. And by the way, as from what I could see in the footage and pictures, Jessica was with Ruth. It was Ruth and Jessica together meeting ordained women in October on Temple Square. And I think, and there were others too. I think Kim was around, Kim Farah. Yeah.
Well, Kim was the one who did it for sure in April.
I know, but I'm just saying that they were there too in October.
Okay.
But there's definitely a difference in the tone and in the welcome between October and March 17th. But again, that can't be taken out of context. The March 17th letter, when I read that, the PR statement that was released by Jessica Moody, there were a number of very clear indications in that letter that that letter was responding to things that had happened between October and then, I mean, since October. So I think that there were a couple of again, it goes back to bringing a secular discussion into sacred space.
Yeah, Temple Square is very sacred. General Conference time is sacred time.
Very sacred. It goes back to what happened after Ruth greeted the group. Ruth Todd greeted the group. Everything went well. And then what happened after that? Well, what happened was for the next 2 hours or hour and a half, people went up one by one to request to get inside the door. So it went beyond the initial meet and greet and discussion. So I think that the way that the demonstration evolved went differently probably than the church had anticipated. And there were so many photo ops and pictures and, you know, it became staging for a story that was told after that.
In their mind, for the women who were participating, this, they needed to speak their truth. So I don't think it felt like staging for them.
I know it didn't. There are two very different perspectives here. You've got two different realities clashing. And so all I'm trying to do, and again, I'm not trying to take...
You're doing good. You're doing good at representing a big picture here, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm trying to get at the bigger picture and say that March 17th statement that seemed so harsh, that upset people so much, that came out from church PR, released by Jessica Moody, that I think there was so much more behind that. It was responding to the way things went on Temple Square in October after they had been welcomed, and then the way that PR was criticized and Ruth Todd was criticized, and I would say bashed, in rhetoric and on blogs after that event in October. There were months of criticism and what I would call bashing. And maybe bashing is too strong a word. there was a lot of negative criticism leveled at Church PR and at Ruth Todd after that whole event. So, and that did not change until Ruth left and Jessica came on new. And then all of a sudden people were saying, where's Ruth? We miss Ruth. I mean, I remember how bad the criticism was of Ruth on the internet, on the blogs.
Yeah. After, I felt it was unfair too.
Cause I had to go out there three times. I felt compelled to go out there and try to give a big perspective and say, wait a minute, this is historic. What Ruth Todd did was historic by welcoming feminists and ordained women and activists on Temple Square and saying, you are us. You are not other. You are us. That was historic. And I felt I had to go and defend her and defend that.
Well, and then I was there both times, actually, but with her, you know, she left it to, there was the fellow who was turning people one-to-one away at the door, but she went down the line and talked to every group, shook our hands, you know, spent time with us as we waited in line. So, no, I was totally, you know, a Ruth supporter. I thought she did an amazing job in a tough spot.
I saw that in the footage, and it was historic. So I went on the blog saying, wait a minute, here's another perspective. This is historic. You were welcomed. You were claimed. You were not othered. Anyway, so basically, that letter didn't just come out of the blue. It wasn't a sudden flip-flop. It wasn't because Ruth left and now we've got Jessica. No, it was a whole bunch of things coming together. It was, I think, the church realizing, well, maybe we allowed too much activism on sacred space, you know, and also maybe this isn't a good idea, you know, and maybe we went too far, maybe we were too welcoming,
and
you know, all kinds of things. And so people can't take that letter out of context as if it just suddenly materialized. That letter was responding to things that had happened in the previous 5 months.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great point. Okay, Maxine, if you have any other things, I'd love to do it, and I don't want to go too much longer with you, but let's, anything that you have, and then I want to ask you one, you know, more of a personal question about, you know, working forgiveness within your own heart when as a scapegoat, as one of these symbolic people with, you know, two lives and things like that. So I want to get there at the end, but if you had any other, you know, points about this moment, please give them first.
Sure. The other thing that I'm reading between the lines that I read in the two or three statements from Mike Otterson, what I hear Mike Otterson doing is pleading for more consideration and respect and understanding in tone. And I realize that people think, well, gee, the letters we've gotten from Church PR have been, you know, sharp and accusatory. But I've seen far, far more vitriol and accusation and rumors and negative assumptions and accusations coming out of the blogs toward the church and toward church PR. It's just been a huge tidal wave of accusations and blame. And I'm sure there's plenty of guilt to go around. But what I'm hearing if I had to make a fourth point as to maybe why this is happening, is that I have the sense that people feel a line has been crossed in terms of tone and approach and respectfulness versus being confrontational and disrespectful, and that there's like a professional level of sensitivity or respect that is missing. And I'm feeling that, I'm sensing that myself. I see it. I'm very sensitive to it. And I realize that many feminists would say, well, we're talking two very different levels. If we're talking about two human beings being sensitive to each other in a conversation, that's very different than, you know, one little feminist dealing with the whole church hierarchy and church PR. Of course, it's different. It's different levels. There are different power differentials. But behind the positions and the rhetoric and all of it, we are human beings. We are human beings talking to each other, regardless of what your position is. The people at Church PR are human beings. I had an amazing opportunity to get to know them, some of them, and work with them on the Interfaith Roundtable over a 15
Right, right. You've been part of that, yeah.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's so true. You know, when you meet people in person around the same table and you work with them, it's a whole different reality than when you're yelling at each other over the internet on email or Facebook. You know, I learned that I had been so wrong about so many people and so many things when I worked with church PR and leaders on the Interfaith Roundtable between 1999 and the present. And it gave me a whole new level of sensitivity, and compassion, and empathy. And that's what I'm hearing almost as much as anything else, that people seem to feel, and this is what I see in Mike Otterson's letters, we've lost a kind of a human decency and respect, basic yeah. level of human respect for each other, and that we're attacking each other. We're vicious. We've turned into some kind I don't know, subhuman mudslinging creatures or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, I thought he was trying to part the curtain on here's how it works here at our side of things too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course there were some sentences that were pretty buzzy and they're the ones that got all the attention, but I definitely hear what you're saying there. I think that was what he was trying to convey.
I would have to say, and again, I identify with both sides. I identify with the feminists. I'm a feminist. I'm a feminist theorist. I'm a feminist theologian. And I also identify with people at Church PR, having worked with them, various members of them on projects for the last 15 years. So I identify with both, and I wince when I see either side coming on a little too strong or a little too sharp. And I have seen more of it coming out of the blogs than I've ever seen before.
Here's our mirror. Thank you for showing that mirror, because I think there's much to be said for what you've just said. Can I steer you personal for this last little bit?
Sure.
It was probably quite a few years before you were really in a position to process all that happened to you in 1993, but whether it was through the Interfaith Council or something, you've come to a great deal of compassion, you know, calling for prayers on everybody's side and things like that. Were there moments or were there thoughts that kind of occurred to you along the way that really helped facilitate the healing in your own heart?
Oh, gosh. It wasn't overnight. It didn't suddenly happen in 2011.
Yeah.
It was a long process. It began the day I saw myself on television in 1993. I was shocked. I didn't recognize myself. There I was on TV, expressing my anger and frustration at the church, and I looked angry and dark. And I thought, that's not me. What happened to me? And so that initiated me on this sort of journey of self-examination that really took me on this other path for a long, long time. But it was a long period of encountering people at the church in new situations and relating to them as human beings. And it was a long period of self-examination and self-discovery to see what I think I did right in 1993 and what I think I did wrong in 1993.
Nice.
And both are there. I think that it's naive and not very self-reflective to argue that we've done nothing wrong. Everything we've done is right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, how dare anybody tell us we're doing it wrong? Well, you know, I did it wrong in 1993. I made some big mistakes, and I had to see for myself what those were. Nobody else could tell me what I did wrong. I had to figure that out on my own and decide for myself. And, you know, I'm very proud of my work, the work I did back then, and I stand by it. But my approach was wrong. My approach was alienating, and it was confrontational, and it was disrespectful. I didn't respect the leaders. I didn't want to work with them. I was probably more disrespectful then than lots of feminists are today. You know, I was doing my own thing, and I really didn't want to deal with leaders. And I was completely ignoring my relationship with them. And it's about the reality of relationship, Dan. It's about becoming more sensitized to the fact, and I would say this is the big factor for me, recognizing your own power, your own presence, and the effects on other people. I had been working blind to my effect on others.
Right.
I was oblivious to the reality of relationship. Whether or not you like somebody or agree with them or don't want to work with them, it doesn't change the fact that you still have a relationship. And I was in denial of the fact that I had a relationship with church leaders. I was acting and treating them like they weren't there. And I didn't care if they were there and what they thought, you know. I ignored the reality that I had a relationship with them and that they were not only one of my audiences for my work, but a very central audience. So I grew up, I matured, I learned that I have power and that I have presence and that I affect people. And I learned to be more responsible about that and more sensitive. And I learned that we always have power. If we think we don't have power, we're in denial. If you have a voice, you know, and you have a computer and access to the internet, you have power. You always have the power of your voice and your truth. And it's more powerful than you realize. And it's important to recognize that and not be overcompensating or acting as if everyone around you is deaf.
Right.
Or, you know, or believing that you don't have any power, because you do. And you are affecting people and they're hearing you. And when they react to you, their reaction is telling you how much power you have and how much you've affected them. And this is a message I've tried to share the young feminists who are out there. I love them. They are my spiritual daughters. They heal me. They are the rising generation. They will take us to the promised land. But I want them to know you have power. There's power in the margins. There's power in whatever position you are in. You speak the power of your position and your truth. You have power. Recognize your power. Own it. And don't assume that nobody hears you or understands. Don't try too hard. Don't overcompensate.
And don't paint yourself into corners with grand gestures, you know, made, you know, within the heat of it all, right? Something like that, maybe?
Right, right. Recognize that every reaction you get is telling you, you have been heard, and this is how you're affecting that person. And their reaction is about them, and you may not agree with it at all, but you have to engage it. You have to deal with it. That's the reality.
Well, thank you so much for this tonight. You gave us the gift of so much of your time on a very, very busy Thursday night. I know you have lots to do tomorrow, and you would have preferred to put this back a few days. But thank you for being part of the series and really providing a beautiful, healing kind of capstone to the day.
I hope so. I hope people know how sincere I am and how much I care. And how much I'm concerned about Kate and John, and how much I'm concerned about their bishops and stake presidents and people at Church PR and our apostles. I'm concerned about everybody. And I just want to say, Dan, since I'm like in this I love everybody mode, I just want you to know how much your work has done for me and my life and for so many people out there. You loom very large in my life as a mentor and a healer.
Thank you. Thank you. It's an honor and a big shrug thank you with that, but I'm never
own
very
it.
Good at taking
it.
Okay, I'll own it. We'll all own our power. We'll all own our responsibility with that power, and that's what you've been teaching us tonight, so thanks so much.
Own your influence. Thanks, Dan.
Awesome. Take care.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
To this. control.